Very kind. Or else you needed a stretch. Habib, I'm only confused about one thing. Are you fired up? I have a lot of respect for my new friend Habib, and I would show it regardless because this is his show, this is his microphone, he gets the last word. I had a very useful lesson in the importance of minding your tongue and manners when somebody else gets to go last. Last year, after a bunch of athletic injuries finally caught up to me, I had to have actually two different bits of surgery, and the same guy did them both, and we became buddies. And after he worked on my shoulder, and over the next few months, we became pals and gave each other the sort of grief that guys do. And on the day I had to work on my knee, I got up, and just to be a wise guy, I took a marker and wrote on the correct leg, "This one, dummy." I came out of the anesthetic with pink toenails. So I got nothing but good things to say about my good friend Habib. It's a pretty good meal for events like this. Really a little above standard. Congratulations to Steve and Paul, whoever put that together. I don't know. I'm a Presbyterian, and we're fond of free meals. My preacher claims he knew a Presbyterian minister who was notorious for going around calling on, you know, congregation members about 5:30, just before dinner time, right? And hoping sooner or later one of them would say, "Oh, well, you know, we're just sitting down. Why don't you come on in?" And when he didn't get invited, or no one came, was home, he'd leave a little card. It said Revelations 3:20. So the people, curious, would go look it up, and it said, "I come and stand at the door and knock at the door, and if anyone will open, I will come in and dine with him and he with me." One week in the collection plate, he opened an envelope, and there was a little card. It said Genesis 3:10. He couldn't call it up from memory, so he got out his King James, and it said, "I heard you in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself." Now, one reason I'm here, and I said it a little earlier tonight, I've done very, very few of these. It's really a treat to do it, but I generally stick to my knitting and stay within the boundaries of my home state or the boundaries of my job, but it was hard to turn down a guy like Habib, and one of several reasons is we've got this heritage in common. My grandparents came from the same area that he emigrated from, and thrift is a common trait among our ancestors. If you think I'm cheap, you should have met my father. When I was in, late high school, got what I thought was a swell idea. I said, "Look, Dad, you know, I've been working these jobs, summer jobs, and I've saved up some money. It's okay if I buy a used car?" Dad said he didn't think very much of that. But I bugged him. He said, "All right, look, listen. You keep your grades up. You read the Bible every night. You get a haircut. We'll talk about it." So 6 weeks later, I show up. "Dad, my report card's straight A's, and I've been reading the Bible every night." Dad said, "Your hair looks like the Dickens." I said, "Hey, Dad, look, right here in the Bible. Samson had long hair. Moses had long hair. Jesus had long hair." My father said, "Did you ever notice they all walked everywhere they went?" Where is Red Bud? Is it anywhere around here? Where's Red Bud? South? So we all heard about Red Bud. I heard it on the radio, I think, this morning. So somebody won the big prize down there. And I hope they're a little thriftier, a little more careful about it than a guy we had. We had one of those lottery winners a few years ago who won, I forget, you know, a few million dollars. A couple years later, the media goes to see him, and he's dead broke. And so the reporter said, well, what happened to all the money? And the guy said, well, I spent half of it on liquor and loose women, and to be perfectly honest, I wasted the rest. So anybody from Redbud, tell those folks, you know, careful. So it's always fun, but it's always treacherous for me to come to Illinois because sometimes my, you know, wise guy mode takes over, and I'm going to try to get in and out of, I've already caused enough stir just by showing up. I try to get in and out of the state without, you know, without casting any aspersions on anything tonight. When I came over to pitch in a little for Darren, my friend Darren LaHood, and I think I mentioned a couple of these incidents. I was up in Chicago for some events. As it happened on the day of the Olympics decision, whatever that was, 3-4 years ago, and hit town in the morning. The place is festive. It's rocking, you know. There's a bandstand. People run around in T-shirts. There's balloons. They're getting setting up a band. We're going to win. And we were for you guys, you know. We'd sent a letter. We thought you might, you know, win and give us a, I don't know, soccer game or something on our side of the line. So mid-morning, I forget what event, kind of event, I mean, the shocking news comes. Not only did Illinois not win, didn't even get out of the first round of voting. Big bummer, you know, stunner. So I'm speaking at lunch to a crowd about this size, and the Q&A starts, and some guy, I don't know why he's asking me, but he says, so what's your reaction to the Olympics decision? First thing came to my mind, I said, what is this world coming to when Chicago can't fix an election anymore? So I'm going to try to be very careful tonight, you know, not create any problems for me or for you as my gracious host. I'm also going to be careful not to proselytize, or I'm going to say just a few words about our approach to governance, our approach to the activity of an organized political party in our state, but not to prescribe. A beauty of our federal system is that no two states are alike, no two bodies politic are just alike. People are entitled to make their own choices. And so I never, however right we think our approach has been, however proud we may be of things we've done in our state, I never presume to suggest that anything we've done is right for anybody else. But I do think there are some parallels between the experience we've been through in years of unprecedented change in our state, a state never previously known in its history as innovative or as a place of change. I think there are some parallels between that and our national challenge and predicament. And so let me just outline a couple of these. We have we tackled as the first of many, many items of big business the job of restoring fiscal health to our state. And we saw it, yes, as a duty, but something much more fundamental was important, was involved here. And in fact, two principles with which our party, I hope, will always be associated. One was the principle of opportunity. We worked and worked and worked to return government to the scope we thought appropriate and to limit its spending, not simply because of some abstract principle, because of the most practical of reasons. We understood that the lower taxes were, the more dollars would be left over to hire people. And that the lower our taxes were compared to other states, neighboring states and not neighboring states, the more competitive, the more likely the next job would come to Indiana and not somewhere else. In fact, we structured our entire administration around the simple goal. I got the people who had agreed to serve. We were all rookies, right? Because we'd been in the wilderness 16 long years in Indiana. Nobody in our team had any experience that I can remember in state government. I said, listen, every great business I ever saw, every great endeavor I ever saw, had a very clear purpose, an objective. They might have called it their mission, their vision. I don't care about the buzzword, but everybody knew what it was. It was in the air. It was on the walls, on the ID cards. It was on the annual report if they had one. And everybody knew what their role or the role of their unit was in delivering that goal. I said, okay, here it is. Ours is, we are here to raise the disposable income of Hoosiers. That's what we're here for. We're going to do everything we can to attract more jobs, jobs that pay better than today. And then we're going to run the people's business the best way we know how so that we can leave more of those dollars, this is the disposable part, in the pockets of the people who earn them. And if we do that, all the rest of our problems start to get more manageable. Government will naturally have the revenues to do the important things government ought to do. But it starts with the idea of opportunity for individual people to do what Habib here did and to raise themselves as far as their talent and diligence will allow them. And even more fundamentally, when you approach the public mission that way, you are maximizing the freedom of people, and that's what America was built on in the first place. There's a little game I like to play when I'm in a high school classroom, even a college classroom, and which I do is every chance I get. And I'll say, anybody got a $5 bill? And, you know, some kid will hold one up and I'll snatch it, thank you very much, stick it in my pocket and keep walking and talking. And after, you know, a little while, the tittering and the giggling, you know, goes on for, I dramatic pause for dramatic effect. You know, what? I say, oh, I see. You know, Habib wants his money back. I said, well, please notice. While I've got it, since I have it, he is $5 less free than he was 60 seconds ago. If he had that money, he could decide what to do with it. But now I've got it. So he's a little bit less free than he was. And that's why when we use the coercive power of the state to take money from people, we should be really careful about it. We have diminished their freedom. And there are many, many, many good reasons that we must agree to do that. But we have said to ourselves, and I think everyone in a position of public trust should ask him or herself every day, did we really need that? We should only take dollars away from free citizens for a strictly necessary purpose, and then, some people forget this part, you've got an equally solemn duty to spend it to the absolute maximum effect. Never waste one of those dollars once you've taken it. So sometimes our discussion of these topics gets a little too abstract and too theoretical, and it comes down to that, though. Do you believe, and are you prepared to do what's necessary to maximize the opportunity for the young people, for the poor people, for the people just starting up life's ladder? And are you committed to leaving people as much freedom as you can? And one way you do that, one way, is by leaving them more of the dollars they earned. I mean, it wasn't easy. We jumped right on it. We did all the hard things early. I kept humming that one of that my favorite old country music songs. If I'd shot you when I should have, I'd be out of jail by now. You know, like, if something's important, do it fast. Now, related to that, I said to our folks, and I've said to them since, to the point of monotony, I know, we are going to try to build the best sandbox in America. We are going to try to build the very best climate any way we can for men and women of enterprise to come and try their ideas and try to realize their dreams. We've reminded our fellow citizens over and over and over, government never created a job. Government never created a dollar of wealth. At its worst, it drives those who do away. At its best, it produces a climate in which men and women of initiative create wealth for each other and for other people. And that's what we've been out to do in Indiana. And we've come from nowhere to the top of all those lists and rankings. If you were any other crowd, you'd be suffering right now as I put map after map after map on the screen to demonstrate this. You know, I since we're in Illinois, I'll just make the point out to you that on whether it, in terms of corporate income tax, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, or your regular, your individual income tax, they're all one-third lower in the state of Indiana. Our property taxes are one-fifth yours on a statewide basis. The average, I'm not trying to make you jealous here, I'm just making a point. The average Indiana homeowner is paying 0.79% of the market value of the home this year. In Illinois, it's 4-point-something, I saw. Constitutionally, we have capped it. When you moved to Indiana, you will know that you probably will pay less, but you can never, by the Constitution, pay more than 1% of the market value of your house, 2% of your rental property, 3% of your of any other kind of business. Our neighbors, our good friends who were on the welcoming committee, the welcome wagon, I guess, that was here to salute our evening. You know, I was really tempted to go out and have a few words and talk to them. And here's what, and if I had or if I'd bumped into them, I would have told them this: hey, you're worried for nothing, really. We're in complete agreement. As the idea of Illinois, first of all, I'm not here to prescribe that anything we did in Indiana is right for Illinois. That's for you to decide. But secondly, if you're asking me about Illinois passing a right to work law, please don't. Don't do it. We're welcoming businesses every day, and we would hate to have that advantage neutralized. So, I said I wasn't really, I didn't bring this all up to talk about Indiana or your state or any state. I didn't. We are facing, and I'm, you know, I went to the Reagan School. I'm an optimist about things in general. I don't know any other operating philosophy that makes sense in life. And I'm an optimist about this country, which has defied the skeptics over and over at moments of peril. But we're in another one. And I think it does not exaggerate the point stretch the facts to say that we are facing survival-level challenge to the America we've known. Not the kind of challenge, not the physical challenge, the mortal challenge we faced from the nuclear weapons of a belligerent and expansionist Soviet Union, but an equally dangerous challenge to the whole American project, the one that has attracted hundreds of millions of people here throughout the life of this country, and that the two fundamental imperatives we must tackle as a nation together are in rough parallel to the things that we did with a state that was stagnant economically and busted fiscally. First of all, we have to begin to square ends and means nationally. This means reform of the so-called entitlement programs, spending reductions across the board. And I do mean across the board. We have to look in every corner, just as we had to in Indiana, until we make sure that we are not taking those precious dollars away from those free citizens, or worse yet, borrowing so many that our children will be burdened with an unpayable bill as their time comes to lead. And as part of that fiscal recovery, and as the restoration of the dream, which is beginning to flicker in this country for the first time, we have to have an all-out, full-throated policy that calls all close ones and breaks all ties in favor of the growth of the private sector, the one that has to pay all the bills for the rest of us. You know, I was on a radio show, a favor to a friend yesterday, Sirius channel, and I was talking to Leslie Stahl and Cynthia McFadden, so two network anchor folks, and one of them says that somebody from, I think, the Catholic Church criticized my friend Paul Ryan and said that suggesting reductions in spending here and here and here was immoral. I said, listen, I don't find anything moral about endlessly spending money you don't have. I sure don't find anything moral about indulging yourself and your generation, spending money on yourselves, and then handing the bill to your children. That cannot be moral by any honest definition. What's at stake if we don't make big, and I mean 50 caliber change in this country along the lines I just talked about, is something really bigger than just, if you can say it that way, our economy and the jobs we need and so forth. We are beginning to see evidence that for the first time in our history, people do not have the hope that has always been there in the darkest hour that we'll come out of this and that my children will live better than I do. And side by side with that, and Republicans have to face this squarely, we are seeing an erosion of the opportunities, and therefore the hope, for a vibrant, stable middle class in this country. It's not going to be an easy problem to solve. It's a sermon for another Sunday, but we're starting to see segregation by education in this country, in which the well-educated folks marry each other, and they'll do just fine. And those with less, there aren't enough of the kind of jobs we once knew. And probably in communities, not far from here, and certainly all over our state. So we've got a big job to do. We're going to need to grow so much faster than we are now to restore that hope, restore those jobs, and by the way, to pay the bills that we've piled up and that we're going to face. If that's not enough of a problem for you, with failure to wrestle with this problem, we will lose our position of world leadership, world influence, with all the blessings that has meant, not just for us, but to the world over the post-World War II period. Now, there is no one substitute for the United States, but we ought not kid ourselves. At this point, we are borrowing the entire defense budget from foreigners, right? The Obama administration's running the once unimaginable figure of $1.3 trillion, something like this, deficit, and we are borrowing about half the money we're borrowing from people overseas. They're not going to loan it to us forever, and they're not going to loan it to us if we get into a position of tension or opposition that requires some sort of military action. If that's not enough for you, then I would just simply say that also at stake in the decisions that will be made soon is the most basic question of all. What kind of people do we believe ourselves to be here in America? What kind of people do we want ourselves and future Americans to be? Self-reliant, self-determining, self-governing, and autonomous, or victims? Needing the benevolent attention of somebody wiser. You know, this is really what I think most fundamentally divides us from our friends on the other side. Manifests itself in questions like how much you spend on this and what regulation is right or wrong. But the basically what's involved has been the steady growth of a view that says, you know, this world is just too darn complex for the average Joe. It's a jungle of predators out there, and we've got to protect the average citizen against them. And if that means that freedom and the ability to make one's own decision gets chiseled away, well, that's just for their own good. You know, if you look around, I mean, every day I find a story where somebody, you know, you can't cook a raw hamburger anymore over here. You can't. Some kid's had their lemonade stand shut down over there. You know, like, God forbid, Americans were about to buy the wrong light bulb, so we had to have a new law against that. And sometimes you can just get too desensitized. You can just start accepting things you probably shouldn't. You know, we had 4 girls, and I always say, when the first one got a sniffle, we rushed her to the doctor. when the last one swallowed a quarter, I took it out of her allowance. You can just get used to things you shouldn't. Now let me close by having laid out the stakes in a way I hope you don't find too excessive or apocalyptic. Let me lay out in closing the way I think our party ought to approach a very solemn duty. I think if these problems are going to be addressed, it's going to have to be led by our party. The other party, certainly under present management, has taken a clear position on the other side of these questions, a clear position in favor of the benevolent centralized rule that I just talked about, and shown absolutely no willingness to deal with the huge arithmetic challenge that we're facing in terms of our debt. So it's on us, at least, to lead. You know, in Indiana, for 7 years, when we have these events, they always put it now on the wall, I have termed our team the Party of Purpose. That's what we call ourselves. It's meant to connote that we are the party of change. We are the party of reform. We are the party of clean, lean government. We are the party that is always looking to be innovative. And we believe we've put Indiana on a lot of maps, and that we are now seen as a leadership state in many, many areas, and that we want to stay that way. And I always tell people, if we quit doing that, it'll be appropriate for us to be excused from duty and bring in somebody else who will. Now, Republicans nationally, I think, have to carry that same sort of mentality to the job ahead of us. I think, among other things, we should address ourselves to young people and low-income people at every opportunity. We should express the very same views and principles and proposals that we already do and believe in, but always express them through the lens and view them through the lens of those who aspire to come to rooms like this. When I'm at a Republican in Lincoln, Dayton, Indiana, I almost always say, what we're for is not about the people in this room. We're proud of y'all and what you've achieved. We're for what we're for because of the people who aren't in this room but would like to be one day, or at least would like the opportunity to be. I think we should exude this at every opportunity. I think we should speak the language of unity. You know, the kind of politics that's practiced so often these days and daily nationally is irritating, it's annoying, it's depressing, but much worse than that, it is counterproductive. We have found in Indiana, big change requires big majorities. You need everybody who might listen, who might agree. And that means, for one thing, you're going to have people who disagree about other things. Well, we'll worry about those later. If we've got massive challenges to face, then that if we got to solve problems that threaten us all and create a better economy, a more solvent country for the benefit of all, then let's try to bring people together if we can. You know, I'm sorry that your former senator and our president has opted to be the king of divisiveness. It's very different than what he seemed to stand for in 2008. Now, every day he's out there slam dunking somebody or some segment or some business sector. When I was a kid, my parents, who were from Pennsylvania, we were living in the South. And first 6 years I remember, we lived in a little town in the Smoky Mountains of eastern Tennessee. And my folks never loved a place more than they loved that, or the people they knew there. But it was totally different to them. And later on, my mom and dad would say that the things that just struck them were so new to them. Two of them were that people left their doors unlocked. And the other was that people would just drop in without calling first. It wasn't like that in Pennsylvania. And, you know, it's been on my mind the last couple, 3 years, because political parties are a little bit like that too. You leave the door unlocked, be surprised the nice people that might drop in. It's a time for us to do that. And lastly, we should be the people who trust Americans, who trust them in two dimensions. One, to handle the truth. You know, to handle the facts. Folks, there's not enough money to do what we're doing. We're going to have to change things, or we're going to go bust. The machine's going to go tilt, and it's going to hurt, as it always does, the most vulnerable people the worst and first. So here are some things we can do to fix it. To say that we can't, it's two different things to say we can't afford it or as much of it as you'd like versus that's a lousy idea you have. People get this. I don't try to equate what we face in Indiana at all with the challenges nationally, but it's the same problem. And I tell you that folks are more grown up than some of our politicians on our side as well as the other side give them credit for. You can tell we need to level the American people about the fix we're in and give them a constructive, positive way forward and trust them to not simply to not shoot the messenger, but to come together in that kind of majority we're going to need to make these unthinkable changes happen. You know, not too many people I know want as a part of their self-image that they shafted their children. But nobody, too many of them haven't understood yet that that's exactly what we're doing. And the other dimension is we need to say to Americans, you know, those fellas over there, those folks over there, they don't think you can cut it. They don't think you're up to it. They don't think you could possibly make your own decisions about what mortgage or what health insurance or what health care choices or light bulb that's best for you. But we do. We believe that. We think you're fully capable of that. We think, I like to say, you're a creature of dignity, not an object of therapy. And when this finally really dawned on me fully was when I was reflecting now 2-3 years ago about our president, our then new president, who had gotten elected on this thrilling slogan, change you can believe in. Boy, it really had a ring. Huh? It had rhythm. It had a ring. We all heard it 1,000 times. I thought, well, that's a pretty effective slogan. And then I asked myself, what the hell does that mean? And the answer was it didn't mean anything. And that, I think, was its value and its magic as a marketing device. It could mean whatever you think of me. So whatever I think changes, that must be what the guy is talking about. Very savvy, very smart. But not the kind of rallying cry that will move a big nation to make big change. So I decided that, loosely speaking, we as Republicans ought to twist that slogan into something that does have meaning, and it's something that might become a way to rally people on the back to the measures that will restore national greatness. And that would be something like change that believes in you. Woo! Change that believes in you. Contrary to what you may believe, we are rooting for you here in Illinois. We really do want to see, we know that the things could be somewhat better than they are. We'd like to see your businesses paid, your taxpayers treated well. We'd like to see you growing and adding jobs. It would be good for the whole neighborhood. It will happen. It will happen. Federalism works that way. And I know that, especially led by people of the energy, people who are as fired up as the folks I got a chance to meet tonight, that day is not far off for you. I thank you for allowing me to be here and for all I know you will do to see that the era right ahead of us is a turnaround era for America. Thanks a lot.